Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Night Sky Productions, Satellite Office Broadcasting, from the heart of Hollywood's Miracle Mile, I'm producer Joe Russo, and this is Postmortem. You might be saying, wait, where's Postmortem's host, Mick Garris? Well, after 3 years of a pandemic, our fearless leader has finally contracted the dreaded COVID. And since Mick's usual dulcet tones have been replaced by a hoarse voice as deep and as nightmarish as Freddy Krueger, we decided, rather than terrify all our listeners, we'd revisit one of our classic episodes. And what could be more appropriate than the man who helped Mick bring the super flu to the small screen? That's right, in honor of the Stand's 29th anniversary and Mick falling prey to Captain Trips, we're going to give Mr. Garris's voice a rest while he recovers with his flu buddy, and flashback to when he interviewed the king of horror himself. So, let's be kind and rewind to 2019 for Mick's conversation with none other than Stephen King, right after this.
This episode of Postmortem is sponsored by Malum, out now on digital and on demand. Anthony de Blasi's bold remake of his own film, Last Shift, sees a rookie police officer assigned to work her first shift at a decommissioned police station. As the night goes on, she finds herself barraged by terrifying paranormal events, and in the process is taken on a journey during which she learns the shocking truth behind her family's entanglement with a demented cult leader. Malum takes the premise of the 2014 festival hit and flips it on its head, thrusting viewers into an unrelenting, adrenaline-fueled, bloody cult nightmare.
You know, at the time that The Stand was written as a book, it was a time of great political upheaval. And The Stand seems to reflect a lot of that. Tell me a little about the social and political climate at the time you wrote the book.
Well, let me see. We're talking about trying to think when I actually worked on it. I would have been around 1975 or 1976. So we were with Nixon at the time. You know, basically there were. I'm having to get closer to the mic. We were living with a farrago of lies, if you will. There were a lot of things going on. Was I a crook? No, I wasn't a crook. What about were we ever bombing in Laos and Cambodia? Oh, no, we wouldn't do that because, you know, and it all turned out to be bullshit. I don't know if I can say that or not.
Of course you can. Yeah.
Okay, I said bullshit. There it was. I called bullshit on Nixon. But at the same time that I was playing with this idea for the book, there was a chemical spill in Utah, and a bunch of canisters just dropped off the back of a truck, and they broke open, and they killed a bunch of sheep. And people said later, scientists said that if the wind had gone the other way, Salt Lake City was right there. And around that same time, I was in Colorado, and there was a Bible-shouting radio station in Arvada. And the guy preached this sermon one day about once in every generation the plague shall come among them. Mm. And I kind of connected that with the chemical spill in Utah. And I was also thinking about a wonderful novel from the 50s called Earth Abides by George Stewart, I think it was. And I thought to myself, you know, this would make a hell of a book. And one of the things that's in the background of that book, Mick, is the idea that the military and the politicians would continue to lie about this even after the thing was out of control. So, because that seemed to me to be their default position. And based on what's going on in the United States right now, I would say it's still the default position.
So this was something kind of new to you. Your books before had been much more intimate and on a smaller scale. This is intimate, but on a huge scale, on a Tolkienian scale, if you will. And so what was, were you looking to do an epic as opposed to something a little more smaller scale like you had been?
No, but I could because I had some money. I wasn't stuck anymore in the situation where, you know, I was like, one eye was on the typewriter because that's what we used back in those antique days. So one eye was on the typewriter and whatever I was working on, and the other eye was on the bank balance, the checking account, the bills for the kids' dental and the camp and everything else. So, you know, there was, and I grew up in a situation where I didn't have a lot, so that I worried about money. I think probably I worried about money longer than I absolutely had to, but maybe that was a good thing. But I'll tell you what really happened, and it's kind of ties in with Under the Dome, which was another long, long book. What got me excited was I thought about the plague novel, and I said, this is going to be great, but how do you tell a novel like that? So I played with that because structure is a big deal for me. Structure is, I don't believe in plot. I think plot's it's the crutch of writers that don't know how to just let go and let the story tell itself. But structure is important to me. And then I thought one day, I sat down with a pad of paper like this, and I said, if I got a pen here, I said to myself, nobody will see this because they'll just hear it, but that's okay. I'll describe it as I go along. I said, here is Stu Redmond. Can you see that dot?
Yep, yep.
I said, here's Stu Redmond. That's where I want to start, this guy down in Texas. And then I want to go to somebody else. I want to go to Fran Goldsmith in Maine. And then I want to go back to Stu Redmond. So that I started to do a pyramid, and I said to myself, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to add a character to every chapter.
So oh, wow.
Every one is so that we start to get a wider and wider view. You know, you think of being a film director having a close-up, and then you sort of widen out until you see everybody that's on stage. So that's kind of what I did. Until I got 15 or 16 characters. And then I said, this is getting too big. This is unwieldy. And I almost ended the book right there. I almost left it in a drawer because I said, I don't know what to do with all these people. I've spread the thing too wide. And then I thought, well, there's a thing that Raymond Chandler said in The Simple Art of Murder. He said, if you don't know what to do next, bring on the man with a gun. And I thought to myself, I can remember very clearly, I was walking on a dirt road in Maine and I said, there's going to be a bomb and I'm going to blow up a lot of these people and it's going to simplify everything. And it did.
Now, do you do much in your process? Do you outline a lot? Do you do a schematic? What I've seen when you're working, like when we were doing The Shining, you were writing The Green Mile, and you seem to just sit down and attack it and dive in, as opposed to being very sketched out in advance. With something as big as The Stand, did you do a lot of outlining first?
No, I didn't have any outline at all. I just went where the story took me. You wait a minute, and I will show you my idea of an outline.
Okay.
I've got a book coming out in the fall. It's called The Institute. And mm-hmm. it's a complex book. It has a lot of moving parts in it, and it has a lot of characters. And it has differing timelines and different places in the country. And I was trying to make all this fit together. But the main thing was the institute where these children are being kept prisoner because, well, I could tell you that, but then I'd have to kill you.
So, I want to live.
Right, now I want you to live. So the institute is this place, and it's got front half and it's got back half. And when the kids go to back half, it's like the Roach Motel. You know, they check into back half, but they don't check out. So I had to kind of draw a map of the institute. And that kind of served as a real world touch point or something. But beyond that, no, I don't really outline at all.
So you trust your intuition as a writer?
Yeah, and sometimes you drive off a cliff. But a lot of times you find things that just surprise and delight you completely. Now, the Green Mile was... when I had the idea for that book, you know, I get a lot of my ideas. I'll be lying in bed at night, and I'll tell myself a story. Well, I don't have mom and dad tell me the story anymore, so I have to tell them to myself. And when I was going to sleep, I got this image of this huge African-American guy in a prison who was pushing a cart full of snacks and little meals. And he was going to be executed. And then he found this mouse and he trained it. And that wasn't right, but it was the way that it started anyway. So I started to write the story, and it was going pretty well. And then one of my agents came along and said, have you ever thought about Dickens publishing a novel in parts? And I thought, well, if I do this, either the thing will get finished or I will just totally screw myself. You know, I'll just have to go away and live on an island somewhere because people will be so angry. So I wrote it, and it wasn't finished when the first two parts were published. And it just rolled out. I can remember writing the last 20 pages of that book while my kids and my wife were in the other room of this hotel suite in New York. They were watching... I think Hollywood Squares and Jeopardy or that Wheel of Fortune thing. And I was in seventh heaven. I was in the other room and I thought, this is just, because Mick, the story is there. You know, you just have to take away everything that's not the story. And then you're all set, man. You're all set.
It's just like Michelangelo taking a rock and finding David inside it.
That's right.
So I remember...
I have to say something here about Mick Garris. Mick, you've got really white hair, and I'm responsible for some of that white
hair. You're the reason I still have hair.
Get out. How many times did we work together?
It's been a lot, and it's hard to keep track because there was, first was Sleepwalkers, then there was The Stand, The Shining, Bag of Bones, Quicksilver Highway. I mean, we worked together really on Sleepwalkers, The Stand, and The Shining.
Riding the Bullet,
yeah.
And Desperation.
Desperation, yep. We've done a lot.
The one that almost wiped you out. Desperation.
Nothing wiped me out more than The Stand did. 5 months of shooting was on the road and pretty amazing. And it's
places where we were. We started at Bridalveil Falls. I wasn't there. It was dead winter.
Right.
Utah. There was Vegas. We shot for a while downtown Vegas. We shot, who was it? Was it Wilt Chamberlain? That's not right.
Yes, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Kareem. It was Kareem. Yes, it was. That was New York. He was the monster shouter. What else did we film?
We shot in Pittsburgh for 2 weeks. We shot in New York. We shot in L.A., not in L.A., but in California at a military base where we did all of the dead airline jets with Matt Frewer. We shot in six states, 126 actors speaking parts, and 99 scripted locations, something like that. It was insane. But yeah, that was the second one. And it was the first time we really worked together. You were there and you wrote the script as you had for Sleepwalkers. And so I'm curious about that process. This massive book, still to this day, probably your most successful book, and adapting that yourself. And you did it very quickly. You did that before I became involved. So what was that process like for you?
Well, it's hard to remember, actually. But for me, the whole screenwriting deal has always been, in some ways, easier than the novel writing thing, because I don't get stuck in people's thoughts and motivations. Everything has to be out where the camera can see it. And you are the perfect person to do that, because you're so hip with the visual sense, and you were good with the actors. You were terrific with the actors. But the main thing was, a Mick Garris movie or a TV program has its own look. I'd know your work anywhere. And I had written this thing where I talked about the Don't Fear the Reaper, and we were seeing the Project Blue installation. And then you went in with your camera, and all these people are dead on the ground. And you used that handheld camera, and we went right through it. And that became a kind of standard. But years later, when you got to things like The Shield and stuff, where you see that handheld and everything, but it had this feeling of real immediacy. You know, The Stand, that miniseries, it worked, didn't it?
It really did. It was very successful, critically as well as ratings-wise. And the fans of the book liked it, because I'm one of them, and it was so important to me to make you proud and to bring to the screen with respect and love the book that I was so passionate about.
We had some difficulties with agency and the whole, network TV. You see, you know, the thing is, when cable came in, it changed the game, didn't it, in terms of miniseries and in terms of what you could show and what you could see. Because, you know, what I try to tell people is, the thing is, everybody has network TV. Network TV is a guest in your house, and any guest has to behave in a polite way. That is, they're very aware that there are children around, and you can say all you want. Well, it's up to the parents to monitor the children's, you know, viewing habits, but it's there the same way that the internet is there now with all the porn sites and all that. But once the people got to cable, you know, I keep going back to The Shield. That was a very important show in my view, because it told a continuing story, and because it broke the mold. I can still remember how I felt at the end of the first episode when Vic Mackey, the purported hero, shot the rat in his defense. I said, oh, I'll tell you what, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. This is a new thing. So that was a fantastic thing. And since then, you know, my son Joe has got a series coming out this summer called Nosferatu. And I've seen some of the footage cut together, and I'm telling you what, they're not playing games with that. That's balls to the wall scary. So, and we couldn't do all that with The Stand, but you know what, Mick? They let us do a lot.
We got away with literal murder on that. One of the broadcast standards notes I remember was that you could not show any corpses with their eyes open.
Oh, right.
During the opening credits, though, I chose to Steadicam in on all of these characters. One in particular, and I think maybe it's under your credit, the camera goes right in on a dead woman's open eyes, and it was our middle finger to ABC.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. And then, don't forget, we had a church full of dead people.
Including you. You and I were alive together in that scene, having cameo role.
Were we? I can't remember. Oh, yeah, we were. Oh, Mick.
Cordwood.
Yeah, that's right. And then when we worked on The Shining, which was a very important project for me, that was a miniseries that everybody told me, well, you can't do that, you know, because you will be, the movie is a classic and all that. And I'm like, fuck Kubrick. We're going to go and we're going to do my book, you know. So that's exactly what we did. And we got Steven Weber, who actually played the Ark, from the same guy to the totally crazy guy. We got the actual hotel, right? The Overlook Hotel.
Yeah.
The thing was shot. And I got to play the dead band leader.
You did indeed, even though we did cut out your meltdown.
Yeah, we did. We did.
After 6 hours of makeup on you and everything.
Yeah, but we got a great shot of coming in. You had to explain to me 4 times what I was going to do, but we have this thing that comes right up with the camera. It's a very Spielbergian moment. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about or not. And that's my wife's favorite cameo, because she says I look like Brett Cutler.
Yeah, you were Cab Calloway, the white Cab Calloway through and through. Going back to The Stand, though, what were the things that came closest to what you had in mind when you were writing the book that you hoped? Were there scenes that stuck out like, wow, this is exactly how I saw it? Or, ooh, this one doesn't work at all. This isn't it.
No, I got a lot of good memories of that, of looking at it and saying we got most of it. We got, and I think that probably, you know, I felt that way because I had skin in the game. You know, I wrote the screenplay, and so you lose a little bit of your godlike perspective with that. But still, the opening was exactly what I had pictured on Project Blue, that Steadicam shot that goes through the bodies and everything. That was perfect. I love that. And I think the smartest thing that we did, and I can't remember if I pushed for this or not, I think I did, was getting Gary Sinise, Stuart Redman.
Yeah, what that came together, an agent at CAA sent me two $5 bills to go see Of Mice and Men, to see one of his clients in there. And it so happened that Gary Sinise, who was also their client, was who I noticed in the movie, and I thought he could be a great Stu Redman. Do you think we could get him? And once you and I talked about that, we both went to the agency, who also represented both of us at the time, and asked if we could get it. And Gary Sinise jumped at the chance.
Yeah, you know what? The thing that always stuck out in my mind about that was I wrote a line in that when Stu was being taken by the Army, to the Stovington facility. Well, he's somewhere else first, but he's being taken into custody because he's in a mirror. They try to blow smoke up his ass about what's going on, and he says, country don't mean dumb. I wrote that line, and he, of all the actors that I know of who could have screwed that line, he got it exactly right, with a kind of a combination of matter-of-factness and you listen to me because this is what I know. And here's the other thing about The Stand, Mick, that I know you remember, was Kathy Bates came on and did a cameo. And it's one of her finest performances. And people who haven't seen The Stand miniseries really need to take a look at that. She plays, I think his name is Ray Flowers in the book. He's a radio guy who continues to broadcast even after he's been told to shut down. And she played it as this chain-smoking kind of cynical woman who's just like, I know this is going to happen to me, but, you know, I'm going to continue to do it. So she managed to project that world weariness and cynicism, and at the same time, there was a feeling of I'm going to do this because I'm a good American, and this is what we're supposed to do. So that was a high point for me, that Kathy would come on and do that, and she did it uncredited.
Yeah, uncredited. She shot it in 4 hours. We had less than half a day with her, and she had just won the Oscar for Misery, which was certainly a reason she felt indebted to the oeuvre of Stephen King.
I'm sure she paid that debt with interest.
Yes.
And it's funny, you know, the other uncredited performance in that was Ed Harris. Ed Harris played the evil general. And I worked with him early in his career, too, on a picture called Creepshow.
Actually, right. Night Riders.
Worked with him on Night Riders, yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to that, when you were writing the screenplay, did you see it as an opportunity to change something that you might have done differently if you'd thought of it back when you were writing the book?
No, I don't think so. You have to keep in mind I was a lot younger then. Okay, that meant that I had a much higher opinion of myself and my work than I do now. So I've written screenplays for Lisey Story, and that's, you know, pretty much current. That's in work now. And I looked at the book, and I said to myself, okay, I see everything that's wrong with this book, everything that can be simplified, and I tackled it the way a screenwriter would, and did that. But with The Stand, what I remember, Mick, is thinking to myself, we have 8 hours to play around in. And it's just such, after having written like Sleepwalkers and a couple of other films, I'm thinking to myself, this is such a luxury to have that space to tell the tale. I've always felt that way about TV, that the greatest thing that it has to sell is time itself. So it's, and the other thing was, you have to plan the screenplay. You have to be very disciplined about it and say, well, there are going to be commercial breaks, so you got to build, you got to come down, you got to build a little more. You know how many acts there's going to be? I think at that time it was 7. Now they've got even more ads in there, so an even shorter runtime for shows. But not only that, but at the end of the first episode, you have to go back and say, well, now we're going to do the next one, and we have to start lower. In other words, it's like it's this beautiful pattern that you have to build up. I love it.
You always referred to it as a novel for television, and that format was a great one. The first screenplay by you I ever read was for Pet Sematary. When I met with Paramount before I'd ever directed anything, I was just a screenwriter. And I met with them about that, and it blew me away. And I realized that you were not just a master novelist and author, but you really understood the screenwriting format so well. And, you know, screenwriting is basically a blueprint, whereas writing a novel. Well, Richard Matheson once said, film is external and books are internal. And I thought that was kind of profound. And that screenplay showed me that you knew what that was.
Well, there's so much to unpack there that it's hard to know where to begin. I guess the place to begin is I'm part of a generation that got story and television before I could even read. The first thing that I ever experienced was Bambi in a movie theater. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I love film. I love television programs. I love that visual telling media. I love all stories, okay? Whether they come in magazines, books, television, movies, I love story, period. But Matheson is right. You know, movies are exterior, books are interior, but I always refer to it as books are like swimming and movies are like skating. That's why they're euphoric and giddy, and they make us happy, because there's that sense of speed and just this sense of flying. And you see it particularly in immersive experiences now like IMAX, which I sort of like, even though it gives me a headache. So I was raised on that kind of thing, that kind of medium. But also, as a student of English, I very much took to heart, there's a thing that William Carlos Williams, the poet, said. He said, no ideas but in things. No ideas but in things. In other words, the image is the important thing. The fact is the important thing. What you see is what matters. So, for instance, there's a scene in the book where Larry Underwood, in the book The Stand, where Larry Underwood has a fight with his girlfriend. She says, you ain't no nice guy. And she throws something at him, and then she cries. And one of the tears plops on her breast and rolls down to her nipple. And in that drop of tears, he can see a hair growing out of the areola of her nipple. And I had a teacher read that and say, that's not possible. And I said, it is, because I saw it. So that's it. But, you know, on the level of craftsmanship, I read a couple of books that showed me the format. That's really all you need. You need to know what the format is. And now anybody who can use, a keyboard can write a screenplay, because I'm looking right at Final Draft on the strip at the bottom of my computer. So you don't have to even like use a typewriter to do indents and all that stuff that you probably remember.
I remember.
Days. Oh, yeah, I'm sure you do. We both do. So the thing was, once you learn the format, boom, that's good. And then you have to learn to compress. You have to learn how to compress. And, you know, I did trial screenplays. There was one of Something Wicked This Way Comes. There were screenplays that I did of my own work. They're all in a drawer. They're all in a drawer. And finally I got so that I felt like I could do something halfway decent. I did a screenplay for The Shining because I had contractual rights to do the first draft. I don't know if anybody ever read it, but that was another learning experience.
Well, I know that The Stand was in development for like 15 years with George Romero attached to do it as a movie. Tell me about that process. And Roscoe Pallenberg wrote screenplays. Were you involved in the process?
Nope. My idea has always been, you're either all the way in or you're all the way out. And you don't, if you're all the way out, then it's not fair to make a big deal out of getting in somebody else's way, eating rice from their rice bowl, if you like it. So I was all the way out. The problem with The Stand as a movie is that I don't think that Richard Rubenstein could ever sell it with George at the helm, because George was seen as the living dead guy and not as the guy who was capable of putting together an epic. So that didn't happen. He might have been able to do it with Dino De Laurentiis. There was a lot of interest there. But Dino, he backed away because he saw that Dino would take it over and he would be out of it. Richard Rubenstein. So it never really happened, and I never really worried about it, but eventually it happened. But it couldn't have been. When did we work on The Stand?
The Stand was shot in 1993. We worked on it from January to December and then delivered it at the end of December.
Okay, so it really was 15 years.
Yeah, well, we did. It's a 25th anniversary in May of the broadcast. when you write, do you see actors in those roles, when you write either a book or a screenplay, do you visualize actors in those parts, or are all of them you in different expressed forms?
Neither one. I don't see actors in the parts, but they're not they're not all me. I suppose because I wrote them, they all have elements of me in them somewhere. But if there's a part of me in Harold Lauder, I hope that that part stays hidden. Although, you know, I think everybody has their good side. Even Harold has his good qualities. I just don't remember what any of them were. The same way that, you know, Molly Ringwald as Fran Goldsmith had her good qualities. She did the best job with that part that she possibly could as Molly Ringwald. So, no, I wouldn't say they're me, but I don't see actors in those parts either. When I get done and we talk about casting, even at that point, it's not a really interesting part of the process.
Well, you were actually involved in the casting process when we were shooting The Stand. And I remember the very first actor we read was Matt Frewer for The Trash Can Man. Do you remember that session?
Yeah.
He brought something to it.
Yeah, he blew it out of the room. He was great.
He had the cigarette lighter. Randall Flagg has the cigarette lighter and shows him the flame. And Matt's performance was so much richer. Suddenly, there were tears in his eyes of devotion. And I don't know, I didn't expect that. You wrote it. I don't know if you expected that or not, but it just blew us away.
Now, that's a director's take. I knew that he could do it, and that was the important. He didn't phone it in on that level. But, for instance, I knew that Gary Sinise was right for the part, and there was no doubt about that in my mind. I'm trying to think, we cast Glenn Bateman. It was Ray Walston.
Yes.
He was right for the part. I mean, he was perfect. He was right there. Some of the other ones, Miguel Ferrer was fantastic. As
Lloyd.
Lloyd, yeah, Lloyd. Polarized him, good buddy. Whoop, whoop. But I don't look at it that way. I mean, it's like when they said to me Dr. Sleep, Dr. Sleep is done. I haven't seen it yet. It's the sequel to The Shining. And they said, well, we want a Danny Torrance grown up. We want Ewan McGregor to play Danny Torrance. And I'm like, okay, good. Because I don't see these people, and I don't describe them a lot. I don't have a photographic picture of any character in my mind.
What's your favorite part of the process when it does come to filmmaking from one of your stories?
Well, looking at it when it's done, you know, the process itself, the filmmaking process itself, I tell people, look, people say, I want to go to Hollywood. I want to be part of the motion picture business. I got stars in my eyes, man. It's going to be fantastic. I mean, Spago, movie stars by the pool. We're going to make films, man. It's going to be great. But what it really is, and you know this, is a little bit like, okay, it's an amusement park. Everybody's going to have a terrific time, but somebody's got to put those rides together. Somebody's got to do the grunt work. So when you go on a set, you don't see a lot of glamour. You see a lot of people who are working hard. Everybody's got a tool belt on. Everybody's carrying duct tape because you can't make movies without duct tape. You know, you gotta have that. And even today, with all the modern stuff, you still gotta have duct tape to put it together. So all that. But here's the thing, Mick. The most exciting part is when the magic happens. I remember, you know, we did Creepshow, and I was on set most of the time for that because I actually, some people would call it acting. I would just call it, you know, what I did at that time. But we had the last segment of that was called The Creeping Up on You. And it was E.G. Marshall who had this thing about bugs. And the last scene of my screenplay had him dead on the floor, presumably from a heart attack, because there's no bugs in the apartment anymore. And then all at once, bugs spew from his mouth, a flood of bugs. And they could only do it once. They could only do it once, and they had a Tom Savini life mask of E.G. Marshall. Do you want to hear the story about the life mask?
Oh, do I ever.
Well, I was fairly claustrophobic about it. I had to have it done for Jordy Verrill, and they would put all this plaster and stuff all over your latex, and you'd wait for it to dry, and you had something to breathe through while you waited for it, because it took a while. And when E.G. Marshall came in, I knew him from The Defenders and everything, and this distinguished actor and everything, and I thought, oh, he's not going to do this. He sat down, and he said, whenever I raise my finger like this, tip a little bourbon down that straw that's in my mouth. And that's what they did, and he was fine. He just sat there and he took it. So he got his life mask made, and the dummy was there, and the life mask was hooked up to a hose, a big, like a HVAC hose, you know, heating and ventilation. And there was a fan, and there was a huge box of cockroaches, Costa Rican cockroaches. They were gigantic. And we had this one chance. The idea was the fan was going to start. George was going to call action. Savini was going to lift up the front of the box with the cockroaches in it. And in theory, which we never tried, the cockroaches were going to be blown down the tube and they were going to spurt out of E.G. Marshall's mouth. And we all stood around knowing, well, we were all brushing our arms and everybody had their legs tied up because the cockroaches got out. They were everywhere. Cockroaches were everywhere. So it worked. And it worked beautifully, better than anybody could have expected. The mouth opened, the cockroaches boiled out of E.G. Marshall's mouth. And George called cut and the whole place erupted in applause. And that's what you do the job for, you know, because every now and then something like that happens.
Well, you talk about the joy and the hard work of doing a film. I have never seen anybody enjoy being on a set as much as you do. It's like this, and maybe it was because of The Stand and The Shining. These are books that were so close to you and important to you and to the readers as well, bringing them to life. But I remember one scene in particular where we're out on a highway in the middle of Utah and with Adam Stork playing Larry Underwood, and we all had guitars and we're all singing The Eve of Destruction. And it was an amazing time. But you seem to be like a kid with a train set when you're on a set of a film based on your work.
Well, what can I say, Mick? I bring the fun. No, the thing is, you have to try to enjoy it, and everybody has memories. Like, there's two things. There's the show, which is what the people come and pay their money to see, and then there is the people who work on the show, and they have their own memories of the process. I'll never forget, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, doing Maximum Overdrive in the Dixie Boy Diner, which was a real diner we actually built. It was loaded with explosives. And I'm up on top of a crane, the wind is blowing, and the thing's rocking from side to side. I get to call action, and the whole place blew up, and we blew out windows 4 miles away. And that was a great moment. You don't get to do that in real life very often.
Do you have the desire to direct again? You did Maximum Overdrive, and I would love to see it happen because you seem to have such a good understanding of film.
I did a bad job with Maximum Overdrive because I was not able to study filmmaking the way that I'd been able to study screenwriting, so that I had some ideas about what to do, But I didn't have the advantage of having been to a film school or worked with films, you know, at a lesser level so that I could see the process. You know, you see actors who will be in a lot of episodes of a show, and then you'll see their credit as director. Well, at that point, they know pretty well what to do because they could direct the things themselves, so it's normal that eventually they would. But with Maximum Overdrive, first of all, it was a little bit tough because the film crew didn't speak English. They were all Italian. We had one guy who was supposed to translate, but he wasn't very good at it either. So the guy who taught me the most, God bless his heart, was Pat Hingle. Pat Hingle was the guy who taught me, okay, what we're going to do is a master and two cutaways. And he was the one who explained to me about, you're going to shoot over the shoulder, you get the perspective, and then you're going to shoot the, you're going to do a turnaround, and you're going to do the other one, and then you're going to do the master, in a, whatever thing. And he said to me, and by the way, you'll get more out of the actors when they are in close than you will on the master. And he was also the one who taught me. He had one scene in his office. He played the Dixie Boys owner. And there was a scene where we had a track, okay, and the camera is on a track, and he was talking to his minion, this young chubby guy, and the camera is moving along the track with Pat, and Pat had a lot to say about the guns that were and where they were and everything. It was a lot of basic exposition, and he did a pretty good job. But he flopped about halfway through, and I was ready to take it all the way back to the beginning of the track, and he said, no, no, you can just do a pickup. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, you're going to have cutaways to the other actor, right? I said, yeah. He said, so we'll do a pickup. We'll move back a little bit, and I'll pick it up from the middle of the thing. And I went, oh, my God, you can do that? So that was like part of it.
Well, learning the language of making movies, that you edit, you can do pieces of time, as Peter Bogdanovich calls it.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of things you can do. One of the great things about movies is nobody ever has to do the dishes, because you cut away from that and you just go to the living room when Dad comes in with, you know, drying his hands on the dish towel or something. That's the great thing about movies. There are no chores. Nobody ever has to take a shit. Nobody ever has to pee. Well, every now and then, nowadays, somebody does have to do things. In fact, in Maximum Overdrive, there is a guy taking a shit. It seems he's in one of the stalls. As he's talking to him.
Also, well, Pat Hingle was in The Shining as well, our miniseries version, and was amazing in it. And at first, he was very grumpy. He came out twice for the shoot. And then I think he went home and saw The Stand and came back and suddenly couldn't have been nicer. He loved The Stand so much. I think it opened his eyes up to what we were trying to do.
I thought he was a great guy, and I did learn a lot. So in answer to your question, going back to it, would I do it again? Yes, I would. With what I know now, I think that I could do a fairly adequate job. But on the other hand, I'm really busy and I'm getting old. So probably.
Well, there was a time where we came close to you directing and me producing Gerald's Game, which would have been amazing.
Mm-hmm. But Mike Flanagan did a great job. You couldn't have.
He did. He did. Well, speaking of new projects, The Stand is going to be done again as a 10-hour miniseries. Josh Boone has been attached to doing a new version of The Stand, first as two feature films, and I know that you've read a lot of what he's done for this. And how do you feel about multiple interpretations? Is it like you can do Shakespeare on the stage a thousand different ways? Is that how you feel about this?
That's exactly how I feel about it. You can do Shakespeare on the stage a thousand different ways. You can do The Stand a thousand different ways. I like Josh Boone's work. I actually worked with him on his first feature. I couldn't act in it, which is what he wanted me to do. So it had to be an audio thing. And then he did The Fault in Our Stars, which I thought showed his grasp of the medium. I like him a lot, and I like his reach, his ambition for it. But really, the thing I'm most excited about is, first of all, we've got 2 more hours to tell the story. And second, we're free of all those things that held us back with The Stand. That is to say, not only is the budget bigger, even by, if you, you know, equalize the two eras, we're free to, in terms of language and in terms of violence, in a way that we weren't with the original Stand. And so CBS is pretty much, CBS All Access would really like this to work, I think, and they put a lot of muscle behind it. So I'm hopeful, but it's early days yet, so the casting isn't complete. My other son, Owen, has written some of the scripts, and they're terrific, so it's good.
Music plays an important part in your books and in the films and television, the screenplays you wrote, Don't Fear the Reaper, into the opening sequence of The Stand screenplay. We use the Crowded House song that...
That's great, too. That was a beautiful thing. That was your idea.
Yeah, you had written in the Beach Boys' Fun, Fun, Fun. Mm-hmm. And we did Don't Dream It's Over. Sort of an elegy.
Yeah. My way of doing it was kind of counterintuitive, you know, to try to make people think, well, we've lost all that fun. But the Crowded House thing, beautiful. Beautiful thing.
Well, music being so important to you, tell me a little bit about Snuffy Walden, because I originally was considering a Copland-esque kind of orchestral score. And then you and I talked, and you brought up the idea of Snuffy and a guitar, bluesy roots bass sound.
I wanted it to be Blue Jeans music. I can remember saying that to you several times. It's got to be, you know, a quiet soundtrack. And I knew Snuffy's work from... maybe from the Waltons. I'd have to look him up on the International Movie Database. But he knew what it was about right away, and he was able to put it together, and the soundtrack album for that is great. And you snuck it in anyway. When you got to Boulder, you had to have some music that was kind of more like traditional movie music.
Well, Copland-esque. Well, for me, this was also an opportunity. The Stand, for me, is an opportunity to be truly patriotic, not a flag-waving, right-wing, you know, kind of...
Flag-waving.
Yes. but to be a patriot and go back to what the foundation of America was really about, because we were starting over and trying to do it as a democracy, is that something that you intended when you were writing the book?
Sure. Yeah, I think I saw it as a real conflict between people who wanted to reinstate democracy and people who were basically agreeing to live under the thumb of the boot of a dictator. And the scene that always made it the clearest to me was when these guys, unarmed guys from Boulder, are walking up the turnpike and they meet the armed force from Las Vegas, you know, and one of them, you know, Glenn Bateman says some things that aren't exactly happy birthday, and they hit him in the gut and drive him to his knees, and he says, this is the way your society is going to be, and he shames him a little bit. So that was a good moment. That was a good moment. So yeah, it was one against, it was the two forces in total conflict. And by calling Randall Flagg, it was one of the ways that I wanted to say that at that time, I thought there was a lot of that fascistic element in the government, in the people that were governing us. And that makes it a really good thing, a really good time for The Stand to come back, because this feels like a fascist regime to me too. So.
Do you intentionally write metaphor? I know horror is probably one of the best media in which to use metaphor, social, political, whatever. Is that something that you do intentionally, or is it something you can't avoid doing because you're an artist?
The story tells you what the theme is. I've always felt that. And at some point in the writing of something, you start to realize what it is you're writing about. I wrote a book, was published, I think, 2 years ago called The Outsider. And at some point, you know, what I get off on, Mick, is this story. I had the idea for this story. I said, this is dynamite. I can't wait to write this and see what happens in this story, because I'm reading it at the same time that I'm writing it. And I knew what the story was, and it goes along, and it tells itself the way my stories do, a little bit like following breadcrumbs into the deepest, darkest part of the forest. And at some point in that story, I said to myself, what I'm really writing about here is the nature of belief and how people will refuse to believe certain things if it runs totally counter to the way that they perceive the world, you know? So I finished the script, the manuscript, and I put it aside, and 3 or 4 weeks later, or whatever it was, that I started to work on it again, you know, I started to emphasize those things, not to try to hit it over the head and put it on the nose or something, because I want to write stories. I don't want to write, you know, political pamphlets. So it just, this stuff comes out. And with The Stand, there's an awful lot of stuff in there that reflects the temper of the times, the lying, the distrust of government. So
who were your biggest influences when you were reading before you started writing?
Matheson was the biggest one. Richard Matheson. I mean, I read Lovecraft, struggled my way through it, and there were some of the stories that really, you know, lit a fire. Pickman's Model was one. The Color Out of Space was another one. Poe never really did it for me. I loved all the Tales from the Crypt, horror mags, the comics.
EC Comics. Well, one of the things that Matheson did that seems to be a hallmark of your work as well is he brought horror home. It was not in Carpathian Mountains. It was not in castles. It was not 200 years of legend. It was happening in your neighborhood right now.
It was happening in suburbs of Los Angeles, you know, little tract houses and stuff. That novel, I Am Legend, could be in almost any suburban neighborhood, you know, Ben Cortman saying, Neville, come out. You can see that. And that immediately, or you take The Shrinking Man, when Scott Carey gets dumped into the cellar, we know what all those things are. We understand, you know, he's fighting with a pin. The familiarity of the objects and the surroundings is like steroids for the imagination.
What do you think you would do if you had not been able to make a career as a writer?
Oh, I would probably teach school until I drank myself to death.
What better ending than that? Steve, thank you so much for taking part in this. I've been really eager to talk to you on the show and appreciate it all.
Absolutely. And tell me when it's, I'll fire it up.
All right.
I'll blush at all the things that I said that were inarticulate, but thank you, man.
There weren't any of those. Thanks a lot, Steve, and I hope to see you very, very soon. And happy 25th anniversary.
Thanks. God bless you, and God bless Cynthia, and God bless The Stand.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.